Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on how fares the tax protester movement when we come back. You know, when you make $50,000 a year, you pay $7,650 in Social Security taxes. Then, in addition to that, you pay a 17% tax on that same $50,000. That's the income tax. That's another $8,500. Now, you just paid an extra $1,300 by paying your tax on a tax. And that makes the real effective Social Security tax rate 17.8%. It's not the 15.3% that's advertised. Now, isn't that just real special? Now, if you'd like more information about tax and status, call the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Help take a bite out of crime. Why don't you call and ask for my free general law CD package? It's a 4-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining. It's educational. It's informative. Best of all, it's free. Tax and status. The school is available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, you can go to our website. It's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email machine and send an email request for your free general law CD package. Why don't you do it right now before you forget? Remember, georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we've been taking a look at the Congressional Research Service, CRS. It's the agency that a senator or representative would call if he had a question about the state of the law or the status of law in the United States. So I thought I would take a look at the CRS for you so that you could see what the status of the law is concerning the income tax. Remember, I mentioned here in the last couple of programs that the tax protest movement began in its modern form with a fellow named A.J. Porth in 1944. By 1965, the tax protest movement had taken on a life of its own. Between 65 and 85, the Supreme Court and Circuit Courts of Appeal looked at some 2,000 cases, 100 cases a year for 20 years. They determined that there were three legitimate defenses to an income tax charge. From 1985 to 2005, nothing has changed. And the tax protesters are using the same 2,000 arguments that lost between 1965 and 85, so that they can lose again between 1985 and 2005. And I made a prediction in the last program. I said if they continue on between 2005 and 2025, they will lose all of the cases that they're bringing into court, just like they have for the last 40 years. You know, once a case has been adjudicated, you don't need to bring it up again. So once you've lost, the next guy that brings up the same issue or the same argument is going to lose, and then the guy after him and the guy after him and the guy after him. So law is fairly simple to predict. You just take a look at what the last guy did, and if he won, that's what you want to do. And if he lost, that's what you want to avoid doing. It's very simple. You do what the winners do and avoid what the losers do. Now, I also mentioned to you the three defenses, and that here's what they are. Reliance, subjective good faith, and religious free exercise. Those are the three valid defenses that the court will listen to. Two of them can be used once. One of them can be used year after year. It's just that simple. It's no big mystery. Now, I don't pay the income tax, but that's because I don't have any income. If I didn't want to pay property tax, I wouldn't have any property. I didn't want to pay the Social Security tax, so I opted out of Social Security. A lot of times people will say to me, you can't opt out of Social Security, it's the law. Well, okay. If you believe that, then you just stay right where you're at. But Social Security is not mandatory, it's voluntary. Nobody is requiring you to get a Social Security number. You did that on your own. You went down to the newspaper office and applied for a newspaper route. That's what I did. And the route manager said, if you want to deliver papers for the Humboldt Standard, you have to have a Social Security number, son. And I ran down and got a Social Security number. There was something that I wanted, and they said, this is what we require. Now, we're about to face that with national ID. By the year 2008, they tell us now that they're going to have a national identification card. Now, a national identification card is unconstitutional. So they're going to tie it to the driver's license. If you want a driver's license, which is a privilege, then you're going to have certain criteria. Social Security number, a birth date, birth certificate, and you'll have to have your documents and your papers in order. You can't get a driver's license. I don't have a driver's license. I'm not going to get one. And if Americans everywhere in America did the same thing, your government would not compel you to get a national ID card or compel you to go through this process of identifying yourself to your master. And that's what government officials are. Government officials today are our masters. They're not our servants. Now, there was a time when public officials were called public servants. They should be called public masters now. Now, you do this voluntarily. You're going to walk up to the window and say, I want a driver's license, and I will comply with whatever you require in order for me to get that privilege that I so desire. Americans are not going to say, to hell with you, I am not going to suspend or give up my constitutional rights for this privilege. If everybody did what I do, the auto industry would collapse by 8 o'clock tomorrow morning, and so would the economy. There's no way in hell that you could enforce this on everybody in the country. What they do is they just take something that everybody really wants, and nobody wants to be inconvenienced, and people will give up their freedoms. They will give up their rights for convenience. It's just that simple. If you make it inconvenient, they'll waive their rights. Now, we were talking about this thing of the CRS as it relates to wages. Now, the question may be raised whether wages represent any type of real income. The Supreme Court stated in Eisner versus McComber that the Constitution limits the power of Congress to the taxing of income, and that Congress cannot, by its own actions, tax under the 16th Amendment items which are not income in a constitutional sense. Why, I said to you last time, why don't you stop having income and deal in property? Property's never been assessed or taxed in this country. So what they did was they got everybody to move from property to income, and then they tax your income, which is taxable under the Commerce Clause at Article 1, Section 8. To do that, they got you to sign a contract called Social Security. Just that simple. So you go down and make yourself a taxpayer by getting a Social Security number, which is voluntary. Once you get the Social Security number, you're a taxpayer. Once you take a job and deal in Federal Reserve notes and commercial paper, you're in commerce. Once you're in commerce, you're dealing in income. Once you're dealing in income, you can be taxed. It's just that simple. There's no big mystery about it. Now, if we would obey God and keep His commandments, we wouldn't have an income tax. Well, I shouldn't say we wouldn't have an income tax. All the people that want income would have an income tax, and the people that didn't want income and didn't want an income tax would deal in property, and everybody would be living happily ever after. I am. I mentioned to you earlier, I'm not complaining about the IRS or the Federal Reserve. They're criminal institutions. They conduct criminal activities. They violate the law of God. And God told us not to do that. And we said, well, God, you don't know what you're talking about. we're going to fix your mistakes. We're going to cut a fat hog in the back, and we're going to have income. We're going to have stocks and bonds and mortgages and security. We're going to have paper money, and we do, and there's a price that we pay for it. And the income tax is that price that you pay. The argument that wages do not constitute income because they represent no gain, however, cannot validly be made. The recipient of one item of value, including money, for another item of value, including services, clearly may result in income. If the item with which a taxpayer parts has a lower cost or basis than the value of the item received. In this respect, if a taxpayer exchanges an automobile with a value of $10,000 for $10,000 in cash, the taxpayer will have income to the extent that the taxpayer did not pay $10,000 for the automobile in the first instance. This would be as true if the taxpayer were an individual making an isolated sale as if the taxpayer were a corporation which sold such assets in its daily business. This was the foundation of the Supreme Court's decision in Eisner versus McComber, in which appreciated property was exchanged for an equal amount of money. Now, equal protection of the laws in a tax case work like this. The United States Constitution does not contain an express prohibition against the denial by the United States government of a person's equal protection of the laws. The Fifth Amendment to the Constitution does, however, preclude the United States from depriving any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. So the Supreme Court has determined that this assurance also precludes the United States from denying persons equal protection of the laws. And they did it in Buckley versus Vallejo, cited at 424 U.S. 1. The prohibition against denial of equal protection of the laws, however, does not preclude Congress from creating reasonable classifications among taxpayers, such as Social Security numbers and taxpayer identification numbers. The Court has stated that the Congress is to be given wide discretion in classifying taxpayers for purposes of tax deductions, exemptions, rates, and other features. These classifications are to be sustained unless they are arbitrary and capricious. And the Court has, for example, upheld as reasonable classifications within the tax law the graduated nature of the income tax rates, imposing higher proportionate burdens on more wealthy taxpayers, and the taxation of U.S. corporations in a fashion distinct from foreign corporations. The latitude granted Congress in tax matters was recently emphasized in the Supreme Court's decision in Commissioner versus Kowalski, in which the court ruled that highway patrol officers were required to pay tax on meal allowances granted to them, even though similar allowances granted military personnel were expressly and statutorily tax-free. In relation to this disparity of treatment, the court stated that arguments of equity have little force in construing the boundaries of exclusions and deductions from income, many of which, to be administratable, must be arbitrary. And then there's self-incrimination and the income tax return. The Fifth Amendment to the Constitution prevents the United States from requiring a person to involuntarily incriminate himself or herself. Notwithstanding this provision, the United States requires all individuals with incomes above a specific level to file complete income tax returns. Now, in some cases, however, the source of the income or the amount of the taxpayer's income may be a statement which would tend to incriminate the taxpayer. The competing interests of the United States in tax collection and of the taxpayer's constitutional right not to be compelled to incriminate himself or herself, have been reviewed by the courts in many, many instances, and they are relatively well spelled out in the decisions of the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has held that the privilege against self-incrimination, though founded in the Constitution itself, does not free a taxpayer from the obligation to file an income tax return. Let me pause right there and ask this question. If a taxpayer loses his Fifth Amendment right to remain silent, doesn't it say to you that perhaps you ought to become something other than a taxpayer? I mean, I'm not suggesting that you give up your taxpayer status, but it's worth thinking about. I remember many years ago I had this decision to make, and I said, gee, if I have to give up my rights, do I really want to participate in that program? Social Security was one of those in which you have to voluntarily give up a number of rights to participate in the program. I looked at it and said, well, I don't know, are my rights more valuable than Social Security, or is Social Security more valuable than rights? And I came to the conclusion that rights were more valuable than Social Security, so I gave it up. You make the same decision when you decide to go or not to go to Flo's Whorehouse on Friday night to have a rollicking good time. After all, you have to make a choice. Should I go to Flo's and have a good time and risk AIDS, herpes, and VD? Or should I stay out of Flo's, give up the fun and frolic, miss the brass ring, and stay healthy? You know, it's just a choice that you make. Some people make one choice and some people make the other. But, you know, if you make the choice and you come down with VD or gonorrhea, you know, don't sit there and complain about one of Flo's girls. You know, it's the risk you run. It's the price you pay for the goods and services that you bought. Now, the Supreme Court set out in Garner versus United States the appropriate procedure to be followed by a taxpayer who wishes to assert the privilege against self-incrimination with respect to an item which could otherwise be reported on the individual's tax return. The taxpayer should assert the privilege on the return, submitting all of the other information. So if the Internal Revenue Service brings criminal charges against the taxpayer for failure to file a complete tax return, the taxpayer may raise the privilege against self-incrimination in defense. The judge would then determine whether or not the privilege was justified, and if it was justified, the criminal charge would be permitted to stand. Additionally, however, the Supreme Court noted in Garner that the IRS may recompute the income tax of a taxpayer who refuses to provide requested data. So if the IRS determines from its own investigation that the taxpayer owes additional money, it may assess a deficiency. In this case, the taxpayer has the burden to establish the correct tax liability, absent evidence supplied by the taxpayer. So the IRS assessment will be presumed to be accurate. And in this respect, the taxpayer may assert the privilege against self-incrimination to prevent being compelled to give certain information. But one result may be a liability for additional income taxes. I got to tell you a little story here. I had a student one time who was a drug dealer. He had been convicted of drug dealing up in Wisconsin, and he spent some time in prison. And he got out, came down here to school, went back home, was living his life, and one day he called me on the phone. He says, geez, the IRS wants me to file tax returns for those years that I was in the drug business that I had not filed taxes for during those years. And they want me to pay income tax. And I said, well, that comes under Garner versus U.S. Garner. And he said, well, how's that work? I said, well, do you remember? He was in tax class down here. I said, do you remember the Garner defense? And he said, well, explain it to me. And I went through it again. He said, oh, yeah, I think I understand that. Now, in the Garner defense, the Supreme Court said, you can't just say on your tax return, Fifth Amendment. You have to answer every question. So you start off at the top and says, what's your name? Well, my name is George Gordon, so my name on the tax return isn't going to incriminate me in any particular way, so you have to write in the name George Gordon. And then it says, well, what's your Social Security number? Well, you couldn't be a taxpayer without one. So you have to put in your taxpayer ID number or your Social Security number, because if you didn't have either one, you couldn't file a tax return because you couldn't be a taxpayer. You couldn't have an account. See, taxpayers have accounts, just like you do at the bank. You can't have a bank account without an account number. Now, once you have an account number, you don't have to have any money in the bank to be liable to all of the laws that regulate banks and checking accounts and banking and bank regulations. If you don't want to come under that jurisdiction, well, then stay the hell out of the banks. And as you go down the form over here, it asks certain questions, like, you know, how many dependents do you have? Are you married? And what's your address? And things like that. Okay, now, we get down to some nitty-gritty. Now, this guy Garner was a gambler, and he went out and he was gambling, and gambling was against the law, and he was making a lot of money gambling. Now, when it asks, how much income did you have last year? You don't have to say on that line, well, I had $37,000 worth of poker winnings. You just put in there $37,000. And then you go on down the list, and then how many deductions do you have, and so on. Now, when you get to a line that says, how did you make that money? Well, you got to sign this thing under penalty of perjury, so if you say, well, I made this money mowing lawns, that's a lie, isn't it? That subjects you to perjury. So you can't say, well, I made $37,000 mowing lawns when you made $37,000 running a back room poker game. So you would write Fifth Amendment in there. And you go on down the list and you get down to the bottom and you have an adjusted income, and then it says, well, how much money do you owe? And you write them a check and you send it in. Well, that's what this boy did. I went over that with him, and he said, well, that's pretty straightforward. And so he filled out his tax return, and he sent him a check for the amount of money. But when it said, how did you make this money? He didn't say, well, I made it peddling heroin. That's a crime. And you don't have to testify against yourself and admit and confess that you made this money in a certain criminal activity. But the law requires that you pay your taxes on your criminal activities as well as your legal activities. So the money that you were making mowing grass, you put that down on the line. And then the money that you were making with your backroom gambling operation, you put that down on a line. And the money that you were making, peddling heroin, you put that down on a line. And then when it says, well, how did you make this money? Well, this legal money I made mowing grass, and this illegal money over here I ain't telling. Now, that's the way the court told you to do that. Now, a lot of people have come to the conclusion that, well, you know, since we can take the Fifth Amendment, they just write Fifth Amendment on the return, send it in, and find out that, no, that isn't what the court had in mind at all. Then they get the $500 frivolous filing penalty. Sometimes they get charged with willful failure to file. It could even amount to tax evasion. And as I said earlier, you know, it's easier to stay out of trouble than it is to get out of trouble. And it really doesn't take a lot of effort, you know, to comply with the law. If I had income, I'd be filing income taxes. My concern is that income and income taxes is not a very profitable occupation or business. I tested it. I couldn't make any money at it. And so one day I woke up and I said, well, geez, you know, I wake up in the morning, I take a shower, I put on underarm deodorant, and I go out and work real hard. I make a lot of money, I pay all my taxes, and at the end of the year, I'm like that guy that was digging 16 tons of number 9 coal, and I end up owing my soul to the company store. And I wanted to get off that treadmill, and I thought, well, let me go look this up and let's see how this is going to work out. And I said, you know what my big problem is? 16% of everything I make goes to Social Security, 17% of the balance. In fact, it isn't the balance, it's 17% in addition to. I pointed that out to you in today's ad, didn't I? Let me run this one by you. you're making 50 grand. So you get $50,000. So you got 10 times 50, $500, $100 bills in a pile. And so the government says, well, you got to pay 15.3% of that. So you take 15.3% of $50,000 and it's $7,650. So you take 76 of those $100 bills and you put them over here in a separate pile. That leaves you with 43,000 and some change, 350 bucks, I guess, change. Shouldn't you take the 17% of the 43,000 rather than 17% of the 50,000? Because the difference is 1,300 bucks. If you take 17% of $43,350, that'll be $1,300 less money out of your pocket to pay in taxes. But the government doesn't let you do that. You got to take 17% of that same 50,000. That's 8,500 bucks. So the government then takes 7,600. Isn't that the number? 7,650. I'll just do this on my calculator right in front of me. And then you got another 8,500 bucks. So you got to give them $16,150 out of your $50,000 income for the year. Well, then that leaves you with about $34,000 left over, right? Well, that's not too shabby. You got $34,000, but you got 12 other taxes you got to pay. Property tax, gasoline tax. Property taxes, you know, that you got to pay. Maybe you got capital gains taxes and various other taxes. Well, anyway, you add them all up and you got 14 of these taxes. And on a $50,000 income, they take about 30,000 bucks for the government, and that leaves you about 20,000. And I got to looking at that and I said, geez, I go out here and I work and I make 50,000. The government takes more than half. 60%. Leaves me with 40%. That didn't seem very, very intelligent to me. So I said to myself, I think I'll drop out of that program. I think I'll quit that. So I took a look in the Bible and I found out that there was a tithing system. You see, God, that is the other government, the other God, you know, besides the God of the United States, there's another God called the God of Abraham. He only takes 10%. He only wants 10. And I thought, geez, if I made $50,000 and I paid 10%, that'd be 5,000 bucks. Leave me with 45. But if I pay this income tax to the God of the United States, he wants 16,000. That's right off the top, plus these other taxes. And when it's all said and done, I only get to keep 40%, and that God wants to take 60%. And I said right away, I think that this God of Abraham is a better dude to do business with than this God of the United States and George Bush with all the tax, you know, with all the tax cuts. So I changed ship. I got off the Titanic and got on another boat. And I'm pretty happy, man. Now, unreasonable search and seizure in tax matters. The Fourth Amendment to the Constitution says that the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated. Well, the present procedures followed by the IRS in the assessment of income tax deficiencies and the collection of unpaid income taxes have generally been sustained by the Supreme Court as valid and that they do not violate the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution. The income tax law requires all taxpayers to maintain such records as are deemed by the Treasury Department through the IRS to be necessary for the determination of the taxpayer's liability. Furthermore, the IRS is authorized by statute to inspect such records and to demand their presentation in order to determine whether a return is correct and whether one has been filed. This summons may be enforced by the IRS by proceeding in United States District Court. The Supreme Court has held that the use of an administrative summons to obtain a taxpayer's records is not a violation of the Fourth Amendment right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures. Rather, weighing the federal need for revenues and the taxpayer's need for privacy, the taking of such information is treated as a reasonable seizure. See, it's a seizure, but it's a reasonable seizure. However, the IRS must issue such a summons in good faith for use in determining the taxpayer's civil liability for income taxes rather than the taxpayer's criminal liabilities. The IRS follows a set pattern of procedures for assessing a deficiency in income taxes and collecting those assessed taxes. If a taxpayer is determined to have underpaid or been determined to have underpaid his or her income taxes, the IRS will issue a notice of proposed assessment, giving the taxpayer an opportunity to seek administrative review of the determination within the next 30 days. If the taxpayer fails to request administrative review, or if the review sustains the liability, a notice of deficiency is issued. So you've got to know what the rules are. And I can tell you from experience that the average Joe Sixpack and Sally Housewife hasn't got a clue. So the only solution you have is to go to a lawyer. Then the lawyer, he wants $1,500 to $5,000 to represent you. See where you're going? I mean, it's either the lawyer takes your money or the government takes your money in taxes. It's just one or the other. So it's either up to you to learn the law or learn how to look the law up, which makes a lot more sense to me. So that I don't have to go hire the lawyer, I know how to do legal research, and so then I go look up the law and find out whether this IRS agent is just blowing smoke or if he's actually got a legitimate bitch with me. Now, this notice permits the taxpayer to petition the U.S. Tax Court for a redetermination of the assessed deficiency without first paying the taxes allegedly due. But if no petition is filed by the taxpayer within 90 days from the issuance of the notice of deficiency, the tax court loses its jurisdiction in the matter, and at that time the IRS issues a demand for payment of the tax lien within 10 days. It's called your 10-day letter, 90-day letter, and 30-day letter. Once the tax court has lost jurisdiction over the matter, then the taxpayer must legally pay the tax. However, the taxpayer's options for judicial review are not thereafter foreclosed. After the taxpayer has paid the tax in full, a suit for refund may be brought in either the appropriate United States District Court or the United States Court of Claims. Appeal from adverse decisions in either the tax court or a district court is taken to the United States Court of Appeals for the appropriate circuit. Review of decisions of the Court of Claims and of the Courts of Appeal is made by the United States Supreme Court. If the taxpayer has exhausted administrative remedies and has either failed to petition the United States Tax Court for review of the assessed deficiency within the allowed time, or if a decision of the tax court and any appealable or applicable appellate court's decision becomes final, demand for payment will be issued and the taxpayer has no legal recourse but to pay the tax. If the taxpayer fails to pay the tax when it is demanded, the IRS may collect the tax through judicial proceedings or through its power of levy and distraint, which means they'll take it out of your hide by putting a lien on your house or putting a lien on some other form of property, such as your wages or something on that order. Hey, we'll take a look here at the power of levy by distraint in just a second. Stand by. Let me give you a reminder that you're listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, history, health, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school direct at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct, to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour, an editorial review, gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. However, these endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that those authors or publications that we endorse or recommend are going to reciprocate. Most of the authors and publications that we cite on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. The opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or of this local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website, that's georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. Talking about the Congressional Research Service. The power of levy and distraint gives the IRS the ability to seize the assets of a taxpayer and sell those assets, and then apply the proceeds to the outstanding tax liability. So they may take your home, automobile, salary and wages, stocks and bonds, anything that's visible, anything that they can find. It's called distraint. Force. It's the billy club. It's a club. It's the switch. It's the stick. Whatever it takes is what we'll use. That was another reason years ago I looked at this and I said, do I really want to be a taxpayer? I mean, you know, it's not a bad status in life to be a taxpayer per se, but there's a lot of benefits that you get from being a taxpayer. I don't deny that. And it's a case again of you got to weigh, you know, the costs and the benefits against the liabilities and the drawbacks. I used the example a little earlier. You know, Friday night comes along, you've worked hard all week, and you want a little fun and frolic, and so you say, well, I think I'll go down to the Ritz and have a couple of drinks with the boys. And then while you're having a couple of drinks with the boys, somebody suggests that you go over to Flo's place and see some of the girls. Now, you know, when you go into the Ritz, you have a choice to make. Should I drink a fifth of Jack Daniels tonight and drink myself under the table and get drunk, roaring drunk, as they say out in the logging camp? Or should I moderate this a little bit and maybe not drink so much and feel a little better in the morning? I mean, you know, see these guys, you know, on Saturday morning, you know, and these guys, some of them can't get out of bed until about noon, 2 o'clock in the afternoon. It's a choice that you have to make. And being a taxpayer is one of those. You know, you say, well, geez, do I want to get rip-roaring rich here dealing in trade, commerce, business, and industry? Do I want to be a mogul of the business world, or do I want to withhold myself from that and maybe be a little more circumspect and maybe not have so many liabilities to pay? I mean, you know, you drink a bottle of booze, there's some liabilities that have to be paid tomorrow, called a hangover. know, it's cause and effect. Same thing is true here with this taxpayer. Now, most people go to school and nobody tells them about property. Nobody tells them about individual responsibility. They tell them about commerce. They tell them about income and income tax. They tell them about commercial paper and bank accounts and social security and things like that. And so they go through the academic process, and when they get to the other end, they only have one side of the story. They've never looked at the other side of the coin. They see the head on one side, and unless you flip the coin over and see the tails side, you don't know what's on the other side. So I suggest that you look at both sides. I'm not here to advance one cause or the other. But I think that you should be informed, that you should know that there's heads on this side, and when you flip the coin over, there's tails. There's two choices for you to make there. You might be happier with the tails side than with the head side. You might be happier as a non-taxpayer rather than a taxpayer. You could actually be happier as a property owner as opposed to being a franchisee. So, you know, if you look at both sides of the coin and you say to yourself, oh, I didn't know there was two sides. Okay, well, let me tell you there is. And sometimes there's a third, fourth, or a fifth option for you to choose. You know, it's kind of like going into the carpet store and, you know, they've got shag carpet and high-low carpet. So you have two choices. Not just one, but two. And then these two types of carpet come in various colors. So you might get pink, blue, white, beige, or green, or you might get five other colors in the high-low. And when you look at all of these options over here, you know, gosh, you know, you could sit out there and say, well, hey, I think that this is the way I want to do this. Kind of like buying a car, you know. Do you want a radio and a heater and white sidewall tires on this car? They're available, you know. Optional extras. All right, so just mull that over in your brain here, little grasshoppers, and listen up, because there are other options out here. But when you go to the government schools, naturally, they do not tell you of these other options because they're not selling these other options. Government does not want you to know about these other options because it will affect the revenue. The stream of revenue is going to be adversely affected. And so government has a product or a service to sell, just like banks do. You know, just like General Motors and IBM and all of these corporations and businesses and governments and colleges and corporations, they all have something they're selling. And you're the buyer. And they want you to buy their product. They want you to buy their services, their goods. And sometimes they use some pretty tricky ways in order to sell that. It's like selling a kid on the idea of going to Iraq and becoming a soldier, and look at all the glory you're going to get, and look at all the free education you're going to get after college. You get these benefits. But, you know, it's a choice that you got to make. And a lot of times people have made these choices. They went to the Army recruiter, and he told them this neat story about college and about how they're going to get all these free benefits and get to travel around the world and see the world and all their buddies and have a good time. And then the country goes to war. And then they sit there and piss and moan about getting shot at. Well, you know, that goes with the territory. Getting shot at's part and parcel of being a soldier. Getting killed's part and parcel with the occupation. Soldiering is like coal mining. It's a hazardous occupation. The difference is that coal mining pays better. So if I had my druthers, I think I'd rather be a coal miner getting paid real good to risk my life than to be a soldier to risk my life and not get paid very well. I got to tell you a little story here. I was 19 years old, and I was looking for a career. I was going through midlife crisis at age 19, and I couldn't quite figure out what I wanted to do in life. And so I thought, well, I think I'll join the Army and become a general. So I went down to the local Army recruiter there in Eureka, California, down at the post office there at 5th and H. And I walked in just big as brass, and I said, well, I'm here to join the Army. Tell me the story. And so he told me the story about all the benefits that go along with it and what a wise choice I made, you know, with the Army and joining the Army and so on. And I listened to his story, and I said, well, I want to become a general. What do I have to do? And he said, you can't become a general. And I said, why not? I'm a pretty talented kid. And he said, well, if you want to be a general, you got to go to West Point. And I said, okay. Well, what else you got to offer? He said, Officers Candidate School. I said, that's the place for me. Tell me that story. And he says, well, you go to OCS, and when you graduate, you'll become a second lieutenant, and then you can work your way up through the ranks, and in about 20 or 30 years, you might make major or lieutenant colonel. I said, that's pretty good. Now, let's talk about pay and benefits. I said, how much do I get paid to start? And he said, $69 a month. I choked up a little bit, and I said, how much? And he said, you start at $69 a month. And I said, when I get out of OCS and I'm a second lieutenant, what do I get paid? And he said, $235 a month. I said, now the $69 a month includes board and room. When I become a second lieutenant, he says, it doesn't include board and room, and you got to buy your own uniforms. I couldn't believe my earballs. I said, that doesn't sound very good, you know that? And he said, well, that's the program, and you might as well take it, because if you don't, we're just going to draft you. See, back in those days, they had what they called the draft. You young grasshoppers today, you've never heard that draft word. That's like the F word, you know, draft. People don't want to hear that. You're going to hear it here pretty shortly. So I declined. I said, you know, I already make $300 a month in board and room right now, milking cows. I've got an airplane, and I'm living the life of Riley. I'd like to serve my country, and I'd like to become a general, and I'd like to go out there and work hard and do a bunch, but not for 69 bucks a month, and not for $235 a month, and I got to pay my own board and then buy my own uniforms. You got to pay a little better than that if you want to hire me. And I said, he said, well, we're just going to draft you. I said, come and get me. I'm an old man now, and they never did come and get me, so I guess they didn't want me. But, you know, that's a choice in life that you have to make. And when those choices come up, you know, sometimes you make the right choice, sometimes you make the wrong one. A lot of people join the Army, you know, like Colin Powell. He was in for 30 years, became a general, became a Secretary of State, very successful guy in life. God, I wished I'd have followed in his footsteps, but I didn't. I made my choice, and I gave up my opportunity to become a 5-star general and Secretary of State. Now, the court has referred to the power of the IRS to levy on a taxpayer's property as an essential part of our self-assessment tax system. Got that? The government, that is the IRS, and their power to levy on your property, take your house away from you, is an essential part of our self-assessment tax system, which enhances voluntary compliance in the collection of taxes. Voluntary compliance. That's a voluntary program. You went down, signed up. I walked into the Army recruiter, and I was prepared to voluntarily sign up. But after I got the information, after I got the dope that I needed, I said, hey, wait a minute. Oh, I'm not signing on to this. I'm not signing into this program. The Supreme Court has noted some constitutional limitations on the exercise of the government's power of levy and distraint. The Supreme Court held that the IRS agents could not make a forced entry into the taxpayer's premises in order to seize property without a court order. However, the agents could take the taxpayer's property which was not in an enclosed area. In some limited circumstances, the IRS will levy upon the property of a taxpayer without first providing the opportunities for administrative and judicial review noted above. and the IRS will dispense with these procedures if it believes that a taxpayer intends to depart from the United States, or to remove his property therefrom, or to conceal himself or his property therein, or to do any other act tending to prejudice or to render wholly or partially ineffectual proceedings to collect the income tax. This is known as a jeopardy assessment, and it authorizes the IRS to begin levy and distraint without first giving the taxpayer any opportunity for judicial redetermination of the assessed deficiency. This emergency procedure has been sustained by the Supreme Court against challenge on Fourth Amendment grounds. And then there's the use of Federal Reserve notes as legal tender. It's been unsuccessfully asserted by taxpayers in several cases. Notice, I want to bring your attention to this. It has never been asserted by non-taxpayers. And that's because those of us that are non-taxpayers don't have anything to bitch about. But it has been unsuccessfully asserted by taxpayers in several cases that the government's issuance of Federal Reserve notes in place of gold or silver-backed money makes it impossible for a taxpayer to have a gain taxable by the United States. Now, these assertions have been based either on the belief that Federal Reserve notes have no ascertainable value and therefore cannot be measured to determine gain or income, or that the Congress has no authority to shift from gold or silver coin to one relying upon Federal Reserve notes. This contention has been rejected in every case in which it has been raised. All right, so if you're going to claim that Federal Reserve notes then can't be taxed, you got the head up the wrong end. In fact, that's what the tax is on, Federal Reserve notes. The tax isn't on property, gold and silver. Just thought I'd share that with you. The view that Congress cannot shift from a precious metal standard to a paper standard in which Federal Reserve notes are legal tender has been rejected because of contrary decisions of the Supreme Court. Similarly, it has been held repeatedly in the cases cited that the Federal Reserve notes may be used to measure income and gain. Hey, we're measuring your income or gain by Federal Reserve notes. Then there's freedom of religion and the payment of taxes. The First Amendment to the Constitution provides that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Some taxpayers have asserted that a conscientious objection to war prevented them from paying the portion of their income tax liability which they perceived supporting the United States military or specific military actions. And repeatedly the courts have rejected this argument, finding that the payment of individual income taxes does not have so direct a relationship to the military actions of the United States as to justify withholding payment. And then there's the involuntary servitude and the withholding requirement. The 13th Amendment to the Constitution provides that neither slavery nor involuntary servitude shall exist within the United States. And although the Supreme Court upheld the constitutionality of requiring corporations to withhold income taxes in certain cases as early as its 1916 decision in Brueschaber versus Union Pacific Railroad, a few taxpayers have still contended, and unsuccessfully, that requiring one person to withhold income taxes on employees without compensation violates the 13th Amendment. And repeatedly, the courts have held that a requirement of governmental service of this character does not constitute involuntary servitude, and that a government has the right to require certain actions of its citizens, including income tax withholding, jury duty, and military service. I don't know how many guys I've had come through school here that have told me, you know, that they thought that that was involuntary servitude, and I tell them, well, okay, maybe you, that's what you believe, and that's what you think, and you're welcome to your opinions, but the courts don't agree with you. And if you go make that argument, they'll put you in jail. You know, it's a choice that you have to make. If you want to make these arguments, have at it. but you ought to know in advance you're going to lose. And there's consequences that come from that. Taxation without representation. The argument has been suggested that individuals who are not 18 years of age and individuals residing in the District of Columbia should not be subject to the federal income tax because they do not have voting representation in the Congress. Individuals who are not 18 years of age cannot vote for members of Congress or the President, and residents of the District of Columbia cannot elect voting representatives to the Congress, although they can vote in presidential elections. The concept of taxation without representation was a factor in the creation of the Declaration of Independence, but it is not an express guarantee of the Constitution. Rather, the Constitution establishes a representative form of government with elected officials for all adults, except those residing in the District of Columbia. And as such, the Constitution permits taxation of both residents of the District of Columbia and individuals who are disenfranchised because of age. And this was clearly expressed in the Supreme Court's decision in Lawborough versus Blake, as early as 18 U.S. 317, in which Chief Justice Marshall stated, now remember, 18 U.S., that's five wheat, that's 18 U.S., that's back in the 1820s. We're not talking about something you know that just happened here under Bill Clinton or George Bush. So there's the story on the Congressional Research Service. Now it's about 20 pages in length. You can probably pick that up on FindLaw if you just put your mind to it. And what you find out here is that the arguments, 1,997 of these arguments that have been raised over the last 40 years, have been addressed by the courts and they've all been rejected. Boys and girls, there's not very many new arguments out there that you're going to come up with. In fact, I couldn't come up with 1,997. I've probably read 100 or 200 of these various and sundry arguments. Some of them are pretty novel. Some of them are pretty humorous. Some of them are just plain stupid. Some of them are a little funny. Some of them are sad. Especially when some guy gets hauled off to prison and sentenced to 5 or 10 years in prison, you know, for criminal activity. And then his wife gets tired of it, and so she divorces him, and his kids turn against him, and he loses his business and everything. He didn't mean for all of that to happen, but it happens, and it happens all too frequently. So that's why I like to share with you listeners from time to time some of these sobering statistics, the sobering events of the real world. When you get out of the Patriot meeting and you've been having a good time and laughing and hooping and hollering, then there's the real world when you get out where the rubber meets the road. And that's tax protest. Tax protest leads to jail. So forget tax protest and let's concentrate on tax avoidance. Tax avoidance is legal. Tax evasion isn't. There's no law that requires you to have a Social Security number, and there's no law that requires you to pay income tax if you don't have income. Hey, I'm out of time. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, talking about the same topic here called tax protest. You're listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. All right, we're out of time. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, and good night, friends.